News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com around the world on the internet. Each week we visit with local veterans of World War II. We learn from their experiences during the war, preserving a little bit of history, and hopefully inspiring you and younger generations of Americans to live up to that legacy that has been given to us from the greatest by the greatest generation. One of the members of that greatest generation is with us today. He'll be 90 years old in April, and he's looking forward to many more years to come and had a lot of Christmases through those years. We're going to talk about the Christmas of 1944 and where he spent that and what the temperature was at the time. I'm sure it's a very vivid memory for Fresno's Lloyd Renfro, who joins us today. Now, Lloyd, let's start off where I like to start off with a lot of veterans. A lot of the guys weren't in the military yet on Pearl Harbor Day, so I have to ask them how they found out about it. But you were already serving Uncle Sam. Tell me how you ended up in the Army.
Okay. Well, I was drafted in when President Roosevelt persuaded Congress to inaugurate a Selective Service Act, where all men from 19 to 28 would do a year's selective service.
And you were already working at the time.
And I was working at the DuPont Company at the time.
In San Francisco.
In South San Francisco, yes.
Uh-huh.
And so that's, so they opened up the draft by a lottery system, by establishing board selective service boards across the country, and they gave each one a number, so they put them in aqua capsules and into a large fishbowl and drew them out, and I won that lottery.
You won that lottery. You were one of the first ones picked, and
yes,
you end up in the service, so they send you to...
So on March 12th, 1941, I got a letter saying, "Greetings, you have been selected and to serve 1 year with in the military service."
1 year. Would have been nice if it was only 1 year, huh?
Yeah.
But I know from there they sent you to Monterey and then
yes,
to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, which is
yes,
a lot of people who were involved in artillery know that place well.
Yes.
What kind of things were they doing with you at that point? And was this a pretty big adjustment for you from what you had been doing?
Yes, it was quite an adjustment. In fact, when we got down to Fort Sill, they issued us some uniforms, and we got they didn't have enough to go around, so we got issued some World War One uniforms, including the wraparound leggings that was difficult to wrap around and fix on where they wouldn't come undone when you were marching.
And your weapons were pretty outdated as well?
So we didn't have hardly any guns or stuff to train on. In fact, the first day they gave us the day off, my buddy and I walked over to the main fort because we were in tents in what they call the South Fort. And as we was walking over, we looked down the ravine, and they were having an artillery exercise, and it was pulled by horses. And when we got over to the main fort, the supply wagons and garbage wagons were all pulled by mules. So I said to my buddy, "Gee, if we got into war now, I don't know how we'd make out."
Horses and mules, and before long, I guess the trucks and jeeps would show up?
Yeah, it didn't take long with the power of this country to produce. The jeeps and trucks started to pour in, and the first thing you know, we had guns and trucks and jeeps and anything necessary to train on.
So you're moving along. You're only supposed to be in for a year, and that's
yes,
going by pretty quickly. And then they say, "We want you to experience the great Northwest, big
yes,
sky country."
Yeah.
Where'd they send you?
So they shipped us up to Fort Frances E. Warren, Wyoming.
Whew.
And that was a nice fort. I think it was a quartermaster fort that from the regular army guys had been established there for quite some time. And the guard gate in the east gate was right in the city limits of Cheyenne. So that was a pretty good deal for us because we'd been in tents and these were nice barracks. It was steam heated and it even had flowers on the dining room table.
And
so
as
that was pretty neat.
December rolls around, you're thinking,
yes.
I've only got another 3 or 4 months till I get out of the service.
Yes, yes, we were counting how many meals we'd have and all that kind of stuff.
And then came a Sunday morning that would change your life and a lot of other lives.
Yes, we were, in fact, a group of us was getting a furlough, and we were all packed and waiting for the captain to come in to sign our furlough papers. And all of a sudden, we were then the sergeant come running in, blowing his whistle and saying all leaves and furloughs are canceled.
Mm.
He said they're bombing Pearl Harbor. So we thought, gee, what is this? You know. So,
had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
Well, of course.
Yeah.
In fact, they had told us that before a week or two before we're going to get the furlough, that they were having. There was some trouble out in the Asian country, and our furloughs might be canceled.
And they were right.
And they were right, yes.
What did that feel like for you at the time when you realized we're under attack, this is real, we're at war?
Well, we just sort of stunned. We didn't know what to think about. Of course, we had a big radio in the day room, and there was no television in those days, so... We ran in and turned the radio on, and of course it was just explaining what was going on in Pearl Harbor. And so the sergeant said, we were allowed to have civilian clothes then. And he said, send your civilian clothes home. You won't need them any longer.
And did you realize right away that you were going to be in a lot longer than a year?
Yes, we knew immediately we'd be in for the duration. So... I tell you, we drank quite a bit of beer at the PX that night.
And lived to tell about it, thankfully.
And lived to tell about it, yeah.
Well, and there was much more to come. The war was just getting started, and you would be there till the end. And at the final year of the war, saw all kinds of action. We're going to talk about that, talk about some of the close calls that Lloyd Renfro had. And his connections to some historic moments that I'm sure most of you will recognize. It's Hometown Heroes today. We'll take a break. Come right back with Lloyd Renfro. Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Our caissons go rolling along, performed by my good friends, the local Sounds of Freedom Band, and they'll have some performances coming up. Stay tuned to find out more about that. Playing that song because our guest today, Lloyd Renfro of Fresno, is a U.S. Army veteran of World War II. If you listened to our first segment, you heard him describe how he was drafted into the service before Pearl Harbor, was almost done with that one-year commitment. Was about 3 months away from being done with the service when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Then he was in the war for the duration. And believe it or not, he would spend the next 2.5 years or so stateside, domestic, moving all over the country, seeing all kinds of different parts of the good old U.S. of A. And during that time, Lloyd, before you went overseas, you ended up being trained as a message center chief. Do I have that right?
Yes.
What did that entail? I think folks today, they think message center. It's probably a lot different than what it was in 1942.
Well, actually, message center chief was where the messages came in and went out. And I handled all kinds of documents, top secret, secret, and so forth, and had to get a clearance for that. And... I had what they called an M209 converter that we could put the messages in, and they would decode it and then put them in again, and it'd come out in the clear. And each gun battery, we had three gun batteries, A, B, and C, and a service battery, which made up the battalion. And they would supply a messenger at my station. In case all communications went out, we could send a message by messenger. And that was basically my function.
How did you feel about having all that responsibility? Because, I mean, people can live or die based on a message getting through when you're at war.
Yeah, that's true. And that was one of the things that and my rank was sergeant. And, of course, I was praying that I'd be able to manage the in combat and hold up and direct the people and where they should go and what to do and so forth. And I didn't sweat out getting killed as much as I did being captured, because I knew how the Germans treated these prisoners of war. So, but anyway, the job I enjoyed, and I usually I reported to what they call a headquarters battery, but I actually worked for the colonel, and I was usually next to his office.
And you ended up in the 144th Field Artillery Battalion?
Well, no, actually, we had several artillery battalions, but when I was in Fort Lewis, my major put me on a cadre and made me a sergeant and sent me down to Texas and to activate, train, and take a new unit overseas, which was a 733rd Field Artillery Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went down there. There was 96 of us on the cadre, and actually I went down there as to work in the fire direction center, because headquarters battery was charged with that function. And when I got down there, I was over at the headquarters one day, and the colonel said, "I need a message center chief. How'd you like to have the job?" And I said, "Oh, I'd be fine." And so that's how it happened, and I stayed that way. In combat, at times they would call on different sergeants to be forward observers. So that would be the eyes of the artillery. So I got that job occasionally.
And I want to talk to you about that. But first, before we move on, tell me more about this M209 machine, because I'm envisioning it in my head, and that's one piece of equipment that I haven't done research and haven't seen a lot of pictures of. I bet our listeners are probably in the same boat. Are we talking about an early kind of computer that you put in some information, it spits out something else? And
no, it was just a simple piece of equipment that you could turn the knobs and put a message in, and it would decode it, and then you could turn it the other way, and they would come out in the clear. So if we wanted to send a message, if I got a message I wanted to send to the gun batteries, for an example,
mm-hmm.
I could put it in there and send it in code.
Right,
and they could decode it,
sounds like it was better than Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
Now, and but did mostly, it always work?
It would work. It was a very simple piece of equipment, and I don't think I ever used it. But most of everything went in the clear, and
uh-huh.
I'd send a message or. There was nothing that I had to send out in the code that in combat that I can remember of.
Now, you entered the service in March of 1941.
Yeah.
It wasn't until April 10th, 1944, that you finally went overseas. So
right.
3 years stateside. You're finally leaving out of New York City on the Queen Mary, a huge
right.
ship with all yeah. thousands of people on it.
Yes.
What did that feel like? Is it something that you had been waiting for, that you had been looking forward to in anticipation, or something that you'd kind of been dreading?
Well, actually, we knew that we were going to go into combat. That's what we were training for, and it was just a question of when. So our thought was is to get as much training as we could and be prepared and ready when the time come. So when we finally got the orders, we're in Camp Shelby, Mississippi, which most troops went in there, I think, and getting ready for overseas. And we got the word that we left Camp Shelby, Mississippi on March 30th and ended up in Camp Kilmer, New Jersey on March the 8th, where we embarked, went on the Queen Mary. And it is a huge ship. I'd never seen a ship so large as that one. In fact, it was taking from around 12,000 troops at a time across the Atlantic. And at one point, they have still hold the record, I guess, of moving 16,000 troops across there in one trip.
And this wasn't a slow boat either. This is a big ship that could outrun U-boats, right?
Yeah, well, when we finally went aboard and they nudged us out and we headed out to sea, we had the choice quarters because we went on early and sort of acted as MPs on the ship going over. And we noted that there was no escort. So I asked one of the crew members, do you know where we're going, number one? And he said, no, I don't, but we're heading south. He said, this ship made one trip to Australia, and you could be going there. And then he said, and I said to him, well, why don't we have some escort vessels? And he said, well, actually, the German U-boats doesn't have a sub that would could catch the the Queen Mary at full
steam.
Full steam, yes. And so then the next day or so, he said we're off Bermuda. It was kind of warm, and then we started headed north. And when he came by again, I said, now what's going on? And he said, well, it's getting colder, so you're going to England.
Heading to the North Atlantic.
Yeah, and heading to the North Atlantic. So the next day we got booklets on how to get along in England.
And you also found out that you shouldn't stand too close to the railing on that big ship?
Yes, we were having choice quarters. I was out there on the railing looking back, and I could see that from the wake that we were zigzagging. We had a zigzagging position. And I asked the crew member why we were zigzagging, and he told me that in case some subs were alerted or was hanging in the
packs
area.
Of U-boats could
yeah,
be
Yeah, U-boats
there.
And so forth. And so anyway, and I said to him, oh, well, I said, I woke up last night and I could feel a ship vibrating a bit. It seemed like more though, so than usual. And he said, yes, we had a sub alert. And they turned on all engines, and we ran that way for about 4.5 hours. So that's how you felt. Probably that accounted for your bit of vibration that you weren't used to.
And they told you, you better not stand too close to the railing, because if you go in, we're not coming back for you.
That's right. They wouldn't risk 12,000 men sitting there for a sub to get back. And number two, before they could get back and get to you, you'd be frozen to death anyway because the water's so cold in the North Atlantic.
So at that point, I guess you back away from the railing a little bit.
I got backed away quickly.
And nobody would blame you for that. Well, you finally did land in the British Isles, and then they would assign you to the Third Army under Old Blood and Guts?
Yep. Yeah, we got into Greenock, Scotland, and parked in the harbor and water taxied off and took a train down to Denbigh, North Wales. And we were assigned to the 3rd Army under General Patton, which was dubbed diversionary at that point, to make the Germans think the main thrust was going to be at Calais instead of at the beaches. So, and it actually worked because they held up 3 armored divisions there, which if they had released them, I think our problem of getting on and staying in France would have been a bit difficult, more difficult.
And that invasion, as everyone knows, began June 6, 1944. You didn't get over there to Utah Beach in Normandy till early July, not quite a month later. And I understand your job as message center chief allowed you to pass on that message that, yes, now it's time for you guys to go. And you didn't really see that coming at the time, right?
Yes, we were in England, and being diversionary, we didn't know exactly when we'd be going over, so the colonel decided we better go on a bit of a maneuver, and we went down in South Wales, and as soon as we got there, we got a message to return and prepare to cross the channel. But that was sort of one of the army snafus, you know, they call it. So anyway, the colonel could hardly believe it, but orders are orders. So back we went and packed up and headed down to South England to the staging area, picked up all of our equipment and stuff, went down to Southampton and loaded on LSTs and LCIs and headed for France.
One question just came to my mind as you talk about passing on that message after you've gone all this way and you're told, turn around, you're heading across the channel. Did you ever have to utter that famous phrase, don't blame the messenger?
No, except there was one message that in combat you don't, usually we'd get receipts for messages and so forth, but in combat you don't. And in France, early France, we had put a prime mover, which pulled the guns out and parked it in front of the gun, which we wasn't supposed to do, but the infantry needs some firepower up there, so we thought it was worth the risk. And occasionally you would get a premature burst out of the those artillery guns, and this happened and set this prime mover on fire. So we had to get a report up to the 3rd Army headquarters as to why we did that. And so when I sent it up to the 3rd Army headquarters, I told my corporal to make sure he got an authorized signature for this message. And he did, and he brought it back, and I had written out the message in it. So I didn't know what to do, so I folded it up and put it in my pocket, in my wallet. And a few days later, here comes the colonel and the first sergeant and the captain, and I knew something was not good. And they wanted to know, they said they didn't get that message. And I said, I think they were ready to court-martial me right there. The colonel was grinding his teeth when he gets angry. That's what he happened. So anyway, I said, well, not only did I send it up there, but I have a receipt for it. He couldn't believe it. I pulled it out of my wallet. So needless to say, from there on, I was in pretty good with the colonel.
Good thing you held on to that. Those pockets come in handy. We need to catch a commercial break, but we're going to come back with more from Lloyd Renfro. We'll hear about his time in combat, some of the close calls he had, what he remembers about some key moments in history as far as the war in Europe is concerned. It's Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at kmj580.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, joined this week by Fresno's Lloyd Renfro, a veteran of World War II, served in Europe with the 144th Field Artillery Battalion. He was a message center chief, sometimes a forward observer, and found himself in harm's way more than he would have liked. Isn't that the case for every World War II veteran, just about? We sure have heard him say that on this program. And we continue now with Lloyd Renfro, who was under the auspices of the 3rd Army and General George S. Patton, of course. Now, you talked about heading over across the English Channel. You landed at Utah Beach July 2nd, 1944, is that right?
Correct.
What did you see when you got there?
Well, we could see a lot of sunken ships and a lot of burned-out equipment on the beach and so forth. And as we started inland and past St. Mary Glace and into combat, you could see a lot of broken up gliders and parachutes hanging from trees, to the result of D-Day. And they didn't have too much territory on the beach even when we got there. That was July 2nd. But we were very apprehensive as to what was going to be in front of us and so forth. And I remember we ran onto a paratrooper, and I told him, I said, we're not too experienced. He said, if you live through the night, you'll be experienced. So anyway, they had a rule, I guess, that no Allied aircraft would fly over the beach after 6 o'clock, so any enemy aircraft that came over the area, they could just fire on.
Right.
So they did come over, and they had so much anti-aircraft artillery and artillery on the beach that when they all firing the blast from the flashes from the end of the barrel would light up the area, and then of course a lot of the small pieces of shrapnel would trickle down, And you, first thing, of course, you learn to, you're sort of like an animal, you learn to survive, and you can tell the difference between a German machine gun and ours. They had a different sound. And also the aircraft, the German aircraft had a sort of a hesitant in the motor, not a, studied hum or drone, you might say, where ours was steady. And you learn those things, and then you become accustomed, and of course you walk, if you're in a place where there's a lot of mines or could be mined, you walk in tracks, truck tracks or tank tracks or stuff like that. So you learn all those things as you learn to be a combat veteran.
I guess so. You walk gingerly in those areas for sure. Now, your unit was involved in the breakout from St. Lo, which was a key moment in the war in Europe for Allied forces.
Yes. Anybody in Normandy at that time will remember the date of July 25th, the big breakout come, because we were getting beat up pretty badly in the bokeh, what they call the bokeh, which was a 50-mile square area of hedgerows and so forth. The Germans had, it was perfect camouflage, and they had all the cross sections zeroed in and so forth. So we're having a tough time. And those tanks couldn't get through the hedgerows. They would rear up, and of course the armored was more vulnerable underneath, was the weakest part of the armor. So they'd rear up and trying to get through those hedgerows, and then the Germans would hit them with a bazooka and knock them out. So General Bradley devised this plan of Cobra and got it okayed by Eisenhower that we'd make a big breakout. And we'd bring in about 1,600 bombers and some dive bombers and a bunch of artillery and bomb of a large area around the north-south road of St. Lo with the objective of capturing Avaranches, because it was known that whoever owned Avaranches owned Normandy, because it was tank country from Avaranches on into Paris.
And we know how that all turned out, and I guess you at the time, you were a spectator for a lot of that. The guys around you, you're watching all of this take place?
Yes, we were in foxholes. We'd been in an area for about a week or so, and every day we'd improve our foxholes, so we had to leave that nice improved foxhole. And we got out on the road and was waiting our turn, because they had priorities, different units. We were assigned the 4th Armored and the Infantry Division to make the breakout, to spearhead the breakout, pretty much. And so we're on high ground, and we could see those aircraft coming across the channel, those bombers, I don't know, probably 15,000 feet, but we could see the bomb bays opening and the bombs coming out, and the German aircraft coming up, and about 3 or 4 of them got knocked down. One of them almost fell in two. And the ground, of course, there's so much bombs hitting the ground that the ground was shaking. And unfortunately, they did drop the bombs a bit short and killed some of our guys, but the objective was accomplished, because they wiped out an awful lot of German troops and made our breakout much easier.
I got to ask you, and this may not be the easiest question to answer, but what does that feel like when you're standing there? I mean, we see that in a movie, and maybe we're desensitized to it now. But at the time, you're still a pretty young man. You realize there are a lot of other guys just like you who are out there, and these bombs are exploding, and they're dying, and this is real war right in front of your eyes. What does that feel like?
Well, you get accustomed to that. They warn you before you go into combat. The colonel got us all together and said that, you know, you're going into combat, and you're going to have to experience maybe your friends being killed next to you or something like that, and that's war, and you're going to have to deal with it, so you just have to make up your mind. So, nobody thinks he's going to get killed, you know, so you just think, well, when we were watching those bombers, do a good job, guys, and make it easier for us, you know. And we were hoping we'd make it easier for the infantry and the armored divisions by supporting them, you know. And it's a big team effort. It just gets where it's not so much your whole objective is to work with your buddies and save your buddy, you know, more important to you than anything else. So, I don't know, you just get accustomed to it. It's amazing how you can get accustomed to those things.
Well, and when it's happening every day, and you told me a short while ago a statistic. Was it the last year of the war? The last 365 days?
Well, actually, we were from Utah Beach to Passau, Germany when the war was ended. They were 327 days, and we were in combat 302 of those days.
Holy cow.
And without being off the line, 302 days. And we, of course, we had the honor of supporting 11 different infantry divisions, five different armored divisions, and even supported the 82nd Airborne when they fought as infantry a few weeks in Normandy.
Sounds like a lot of guys who could say thank you to you for what you and your unit did.
Yeah.
So the breakout at St. Lo was July 25th of 44.
Yeah.
Little more than a month past that was when Paris was liberated.
Yeah,
you thought you guys were going to get in on that, but something got in the way.
Oh, yeah. Gee, well, it was August 3rd when the Third Army came in. And so we left the First Army and went back to the Third and joined the 20th Corps, which was known as under General Walker, which was known as the Ghost Corps at the time.
Right.
And so we headed toward Paris, and we could almost see Paris when they diverted us around it, and we went down toward Reims and then headed north up toward Verdun, where we ran out of gas, and we were waiting for fuel. We turned on the radio, and the Allied troops were liberating Paris. So here we are missing out on all that wine, champagne, and those hugs and kisses from those appreciative Parisians.
You sound like you're a little jealous there.
Yeah, really.
Well, and if we fast forward a few months from there, and we're going to catch a commercial here in a minute, but December of 44, everyone knows the Battle of the Bulge started December 16th, 44. Your unit was on the outskirts of that, but I imagine the winter was still just as severe for you as it was for anybody else.
Yes, it was snowing and very cold. We had left the last town in France and entered Germany itself, and we were there for, we sent our B battery up toward Bastogne, and the rest of us stayed down on the Saar River, and we were there for about a month while the Battle of the Bulge was going on, and I think you could write a book in that one position. Because it seemed like a lot of things happened there.
Now, I'm going to ask you specifically about one thing that occurred during that time, but we need to catch this final commercial break. So when we come back, we're going to hear that story and about the apple tree that stands out in your memory from World War II. We'll be right back with Fresno's Lloyd Renfro as Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me till I come marching home.
The late, great Glenn Miller and his orchestra with Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree. That song has a special connection for our guest this week, Lloyd Renfro. That's because he was next to an apple tree, leaning on an apple tree, not sitting under it, and very well could have lost his life there. He's going to explain that story to us. But first, let's pick up where we left off, talking about the time around the Battle of the Bulge. You're on the outskirts of that battle. You're along the Saar River. And you set up an observation post on a hill overlooking a downed bridge that was down below you on the river. You're supposed to keep an eye on some enemy pillboxes and, if need be, call in a mortar barrage if you saw some activity down there. And about 2:30 in the morning, your phone rings, and that phone wasn't supposed to ring, right?
Right. We were up so close that what we would do is blow in the receiver, and they would alert the operator back at the headquarters and let them know we're still there. And about 2:30 in the morning, the phone rang, and I thought, who's ringing this phone? So I picked it up, and there was a voice on the end, a very broken English and a German accent, said, we know you're up there, and we've cut your line and cut your phone line, hooked onto it, and we're coming up to get you. And he hangs up. So I didn't know what to think of just all of us. Why did he tell us he was coming up there? You know, I tried
pretty brash and cocky.
And yeah. So anyway, the phone line, and when he hung up, of course, the phone line went dead. So I went out to alert the radio operator. I had a radio operator, two infantrymen, and a machine gunner with me, and to alert them, and they were probably a large patrol coming our way. So I told them that they didn't have to say, challenge them, say halt or anything. If they saw a movement or boy, just shoot, because nobody's supposed to come up there without letting us know. So anyway, a little while later, one of the infantry guys made a mistake, and he saw some images coming up, and he yelled halt, and of course he immediately got hit with a burp gun, and his buddy, that infantryman, had a BAR, and he opened up with that, and of course I opened up with my carbine, and then this kid we had a 50 caliber machine gun on a ground mount, and he opened up with that, and of course got into a quick firefight there, and it was over. I think they pulled back because they didn't realize that we had that kind of firepower. Usually in an observation post, there's only a couple of guys. But the radio operator, we didn't have any communication, and the radio wasn't working. But the radio operator got his radio working and contacted. We had a mortar outfit right behind the hill, and we contacted them, and they sent up a corpsman to take care of our wounded guy, and I still don't know if he lived or not. But
have you ever thought what would have happened if they didn't ring your phone and tell you they were coming for you?
Well, we would have. I thought about that, but we were alert to that fact, and they were pre-told what might happen. And of course, when they did tell us they were coming up there, we got all set. Sometimes I wonder if they were wanting to give up, maybe, you know, because here we were from the beach all the way into Germany. It didn't take an Einstein that they were losing the war, you know.
But when they unloaded with that burp gun, kind of tells you they weren't giving up.
They weren't giving up, yes.
Now, we're running short on time, but I want to ask you before we get to this apple tree story, you remember that Christmas, 1944, and can quickly share how you spent it?
Well, yes, we were in a cellar with some people. We were being shelled. This is pre-Christmas, just before Christmas, and we had got the mail had come in, and we had a few packages, and this Frenchman and his wife and two daughters, and we shared our cookies with them that night in between the bombings. And the next day we moved into Germany.
Well, I trust it'll be a much more peaceful Christmas for you this year.
I hope so.
This week. And we know it will be. Okay, let's talk about the apple tree now. And I understand the way the story goes. You're standing next to an apple tree in this orchard, writing on a notepad, making some notes about artillery positions.
No, I was, one of my jobs was to get out the password, which changed every day.
Gotcha.
And I was writing out the password and going to have the messengers take it to each respective battery and where they'd know what it was. And I was actually sitting down, leaning up against the apple tree when I heard some aircraft coming, and I looked down the valley, and there was about 12 or so aircraft real low. And I thought they were ours, but then something told me to look again, and I could see the swastikas under the wing. So I threw my pad and dived. There was a pig pen about 20 feet away or so, and I dived into this pig pen and had some boards on the top, upset the pigs in there.
I bet.
And everybody was taking cover, of course. Their primary objective was not us. It was, we found out later, it was a supply dump behind us, but before we were so, they could see us there, so they gave us a few shots as they went over, and they set a few trucks afire. So when it was all over, I went back to pick up my pad, and I looked at this apple tree, and there were some bullet holes right where I was leaning. I was glad I dived into the pig pen.
Amen. Those pigs never smelled better.
Right.
That's a close call for sure, and I guess don't sit under the apple tree has a little different meaning for you.
Right.
So you move on from there, and you talked about the 327 days from when you hit the European continent. You're in combat for 302 of them.
Right.
I have here a little bit of a statement from Joseph Driscoll, the war reporter who was with General Patton's army, and he talked about a headline from the London Herald on a Sunday. It said, "The Ghost Corps is laid," and here's the text of that article. "The secrecy which for weeks has surrounded the mysterious Ghost Corps was lifted today. Major General Walton H. Walker, 20 Corps, has been the spearhead of the great eastward drive by General Patton's Third Army across France, distinguished by its bold tactics of encirclement, which won Mr. Churchill's praise in Parliament the other day. Within 15 days, General Walker led his corps across six rivers to liberate scores of towns and cities," and it names the towns and cities and goes on to describe all of the accomplishments. When you guys heard about that kind of recognition, does that mean anything to you, or are you just saying, well, it's not going to mean anything unless we get home?
No, any information like that is a shot in the arm to the troops. The recognition is a powerful thing.
Okay, and the final couple minutes here, I know there were some other close calls. One time a bomb landed not too far from you and stuck in the snow and
right.
did not explode, and
right.
you weren't dumb enough to go mess with it, which, good on your part, otherwise you might not be here talking to me.
Right.
But do you remember when you heard the war is over, May 1945, when you finally get word, this is over, I get to go back home?
Oh, definitely. We were in Passau, Germany. We'd fired on that city a few rounds, and white sheets came out, so we stopped firing. And we were told that the war was about to end, and the next day they would announce the end of the war, so they set up speakers we could listen to, and they announced the end of the war while we were listening there, and that was May 9th, 1945.
A lot of cheering.
A lot of cheering. Well, actually, there wasn't too much celebration because they told us to be careful because there was a lot of German troops in there who may not have gotten the word.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there was a couple of aircraft strafed the bridge over the Danube River right while they were announcing the end of the war. And we understood that one of the Army engineers got hit right while they were announcing the end of the war.
I've interviewed one veteran who some of his fellow soldiers were killed after the surrender had been signed in Italy. We've got about a minute left in the show. I want to read something else here.
Okay.
On May 9th, the day you just referenced, one of the brigadier generals recognize your unit as well, and I think this little section is worth reading, sharing with our listeners. "The magnificent accomplishments of the 20th Corps of the 3rd U.S. Army could not have been realized without the able, vigorous, and ever-alert work of units of 20 Corps artillery. You demolished enemy strong points, harassed enemy supply lines, and cut a path through the defenses of the Siegfried Line. At all times, you delivered accurate, heavy, and timely fire when called for by our advancing forces. You silenced the hostile batteries that attempted to slow the progress of our troops. You have in every way justified the faith placed in you." That line, that last line there, Lloyd, feels awfully good, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well, and you have. And we're out of time for this program today, but I want to thank you so much for your service to our country and for sharing some of these experiences with us today. Have a Merry Christmas and a happy 90th birthday here in a few months.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. And if I knew I was going to live so long, I'd have taken better care of myself.
Well, I think you're doing pretty well. Lloyd Renfro of Fresno has been our guest today. Hope you'll tune back in next Sunday for another edition of Hometown Heroes. Email me, paul@kmj580.com, if you have a veteran you think I ought to catch up with. Thanks for listening today on News Talk 580 KMJ.